Well, that was odd. We got some kind of strange echo going on this morning, but sorry about that, folks. We'll get back into it right now. Good morning, and welcome to Fiber Hooligan. I'm your host, Benjamin Levesey, and for the next hour, I'd like to invite you to grab your cup of coffee, tea, or Diet Dr. Pepper, if that's your beverage of choice, and settle in for the ninth episode of Fiber Hooligan. For those of you who are wondering who the heck I am, I'm the guy that couldn't keep his show from having a weird kind of reverb there at the beginning, but more importantly, I'm the CEO of XRX Inc., home of Knitters Magazine, XRX Books, and Stitches Expos, and I'm broadcasting live from our offices here in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. My guest today is the owner and creative force behind Prism Yarn. She specializes in color and hand-dyed yarns and has published over 70 pattern books for Prism. She's also written 6 books, including her newest book, Artful Colors, Mindful Knits, from XRX Books. She teaches and designs with a no-rules approach and has very popular classes are designed to bring out creativity within all of us. She is one of the smartest people I've ever met, and she is somebody that I've leaned on for advice many times. I'm speaking of my good friend Laura Bryant, who joins us from St. Petersburg, Florida. Good morning, Laura, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Benjamin. Not morning for me anymore. Good afternoon,
right,
Benjamin.
It's afternoon for you. Yeah, it's afternoon. So, beautiful morning or beautiful afternoon?
It's, it's fine. It's typical Florida. It's a little overcast at the moment, a really pleasant temperature. When the sun's not beating on you, it's not bad this time of year. And so we welcome the shade.
Oh, okay. Well, that's okay. Did you manage to have any fun this weekend?
I did. We got out on our boat, managed not to get sunburned, which this time of year is a really good thing. It's funny, you know, it's springtime and nobody's thinking so much that we are actually only about a month away from the sun being at its, strongest. And so it's easy to say, oh, well, it's not that hot, and you have to be extra vigilant at any rate. We managed to escape unburned.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a busy weekend myself. My daughter graduated, so I had the chaos that is family coming into town and parties and plans and, you know, sitting through a commencement ceremony. I have to say I was lucky. The principal told some really bad jokes, but they were like good bad jokes, you know?
Well, that's fun. That's fun.
I know.
We had a whole gang over for Mother's Day. We had 10 of us. There were 3 moms and some batching friends whose family was out of town, and it was all good.
That is actually pretty cool. I think Mother's Day this year at our house got eaten by Samantha's graduation, it was kind of cool because Samantha, her mom, and her mom's mom were all in the same house together, so there was that kind of thing going on. That was kind of neat.
Yep. Good time of year.
It is a good time of year. And we finally have spring, which is nice. I'm really happy to see that. Yep. It's nice to see it. So anyway, enough with the chit-chat. Let's start out, and I can't believe that I have to introduce you too much or that I have to ask you to tell us about you, because I would assume that everybody knows everything about you. You're famous. but for our Fiber Hooligans out there who don't know who you are, can you give us a little background about you? Tell us your story. How did you get there from where you started?
Sure. It's actually that is often an interesting thing to people because it's such a bizarre thing, such a bizarre industry to wind up in, this one. It's just not something that you go to school and all of a sudden someone says, oh, I think I'll be in the knitting yarn industry. It just doesn't really happen that way. For me, I started out, I'm one of those odd people who's very right brain, left brain, both. One of those strange people whose SAT scores were like within 25 points of each other, both math and verbal. And that's been a good thing for me through the years because while I guess creativity comes fairly naturally to me, I don't have to struggle as much with the practical side of things. I kind of have a somewhat reasonable grasp on that. At any rate, that practical side of me thought I'd be an attorney. I was in college barreling through at quite a great rate between AP classes and taking extra credits and having gone when I was a senior at high school. I went to a very small rural school and they didn't have very much to offer to me the last year, so they let me go up to Flint, Michigan, which was about a half-hour drive north of where I grew up, and take classes at the U of M branch there, because they didn't know what to do with me anymore. I think I was disrupting classes, actually. I had a lot of questioning authority going on there, and they needed to figure out some way to get me occupied. At any rate, I was barreling through college and was going to finish in 3 years and go on to law school, and I made the fatal, well, I guess it wasn't, the fatal decision to take a little two-credit drawing course, and found myself spending 20 hours a week on stuff for this two-credit drawing class because I wanted to. And at the end of that semester, I listened to myself and said, yourself is trying to tell you something. This is where your passion is. You need to go follow it. So I transferred to the art school at the University of Michigan, planning to spend a year getting a decent portfolio together and then hoping to go somewhere art prestigious like Pratt or Rhode Island School of Design. Well, I really fell into that one because the University of Michigan had just the prior year decided to break the art school away from being just a department of the architecture school, and they had built a brand new building, and they had spent a huge amount of money recruiting top-notch faculty from all over the country, and made this huge commitment to having an excellent school of art and design. And when I got there, I said, I'm never leaving here. That was almost true that I never left because my three-year hustle through college turned into a five-year marathon. Once you have all those credits, all those elective credits for academics, I had more than I could use. You can't take enough studio classes in a year to keep up with it. So it turned into 5 years, and very happily so. And when I left college, all I wanted to do was make artwork, but that's not real practical. And I was showing my work and connected to a few galleries and actually doing pretty well. But one of our lovely little recessions that happened periodically hit in 1982, and everybody stopped buying artwork. My work was selling well in a corporate market. I do weaving, but they're highly structured, very geometric, highly colored, non-representational work that is not in any way overtly feminine. And so it appeals very much to a corporate clientele because it's non-controversial, you know, it's not making any political statements, it's, like I said, not overtly feminine, so men tend to like it, they like the structure of it. At any rate, because I was selling all in a corporate market, there weren't any corporations buying artwork at that point. And I was working part-time as a clerk and doing finishing at one of our local yarn shops, and that I realized that there was such a thing as sales representatives. They would come in and show the owner the new yarns for the season, and I said, that's interesting. And in that same time period, one of the sales reps who called on our store regularly lived in town. He was an underemployed engineer. It was bad times. Everybody was doing stuff that they shouldn't have been doing. When he finally got a job in his field, he suggested to me that I could take his lines, and I thought, really? Do you think I could do that? Wow. And I would think I was 25 years old. And he said, yeah, I'll put in a good word for you. So I talked my way into being a sales rep for those companies that he had been repping for. And that was Taki and Barocco, I mean, very good lines. And they encouraged me to find other lines. They said, we're not enough. It's too hard to make a living, so you need to have more. And I talked Ironstone, if anybody remembers Ironstone. I was their first sales rep ever. I talked them into taking me on. And so I went out on the road. Well, that was kind of a pie-in-the-sky idea as well, because the territory that they gave me was upstate New York. exclusive of Westchester County, Long Island, and Manhattan. So it was a huge number of miles that I was traveling every week. And Buffalo, where I lived, was the biggest city that in my territory, but it was kind of hard to make a living, as it's very hard now for sales reps to make a living as well. Just not an easy thing. But it did get me out into the marketplace to TNNA shows, where I saw TNNA being the wholesale trade shows where all the yarn companies come and show their lines to stores who are stocking their stores. And the first time I walked down the aisles of TNNA and saw somebody doing hand-dyed yarn, I was gobsmacked. It was amazing. I thought, hand-dyed yarn? People want to knit with hand-dyed yarn? Why didn't I think of this? What a good idea. Gee, I know how to do this. And I kind of went running over to Diane Friedman. Actually, I probably didn't go running over. I think I thought about it for a while. But Diane Friedman at Taki, and I said, why don't we take this yarn that you import already, and why don't I dye it? She said, oh, that's a good idea. We did things very casually then. That's a good idea. She sent me 10 bags and said, develop a color line, and I did, and that was how Prism was born, my company. She said, okay, we're going to do this. You need to have a logo. You need to have a company name. This is going to be dyed for Taki by. So I did all of that, kind of, and she really mentored me, and I am forever grateful to her for doing that, because really she gave me the start as an individual company. And when I later, not so much later, we did that for a couple of years very successfully. But for them, it wasn't their main purpose, being a hand-dyed yarn company at all, or even promoting hand-dyed yarn. And they kind of lost interest in it, but I kept getting more and more interested. And eventually, of course, what happened is we just parted ways very amicably. They've stayed very good friends of mine. And I went after Prism wholeheartedly and started going to TNNA shows on my own. And I started Prism in 1984, so I've been at this a really long time. It's kind of astounding to think about how long it's been. And here I am, this many years later, still dyeing yarn.
Well, and it's beautiful yarn. There's a couple things you left out of your story I'd like to get back to just to make sure our listeners hear about it. When you made the transition from taking the Taki Stacy Charles, or was it back then it was just Taki yarn, and you had to make that commitment from getting this thing and starting to source from scratch. And sourcing from scratch is a big commitment financially. Yes. I mean, that must have been a scary thing. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I can. Good call. Good question. When I started thinking about going off on my own, they used to have a show in New York City called the Knitting Yarn Fair or something like that. And it was the mills coming from all over the world to show what they can do. And there's still something similar to that now called Spin Expo. And so this gives you a chance to source things directly from the mills. But now you're talking about commitments that are very major, because you can get very good prices on yarn, but you're talking about, 600 pounds of yarn. And one of the things that I had been dyeing was mohair that we were selling in these big sweater balls. And it was pretty successful, but I was limited because I was buying it basically from a wholesaler. So I was paying far more for it than I should have. And I found a mill in England that would sell me 600 pounds of mohair. And I went back home and said to my dear husband, Matt, okay, I found it. I found the mohair I want, and I can do it. And it's 600 pounds. And he said, "Well, do you have the money? In my little bank account from my business?" And I said, "Yes, I do. I have enough money to do it." It was about a $10,000 commitment at the time. And he said, "Okay, so do it." And I said, "Oh my God, what if it doesn't sell? Is this a good idea? What if I get stuck with it?" And he's very, very very practical, very business-oriented, and he said, okay, what's the worst-case scenario? Are you getting it for a good price? Yes, I'm getting it for a good price. And the absolute worst thing that happens is you turn around and sell it undyed for what you paid for it. If the price is that good, there will be other people who want it, and you'll consider it a lesson learned. And I said, okay. And basically, he pushed me out of the nest and said, go do it. So that, of course, just led to all the rest of my own fiber hooliganism. Pretty considerable.
It is. It is. And so this is step one. You get help from your dear husband. And we'll talk a little bit more about him because I think Matt's wonderful. But let's talk about your first rep. Let's talk about the first person who was taking your yarn out there besides yourself and selling it.
That was my mom.
That's right.
Yeah, it was my mom. She had, she and my dad had a not so happy late middle age divorce, and she had gone to art school where I was, but an art degree is a wonderful thing, but it's not exactly a ticket to a job, and she's been out of the workforce for so long, she didn't really have a clue how to go get a job, and some of the same companies that I was repping for had territory available in Florida. So she wound up repping for them, and she would take garbage bags full of my mohair in Florida and leave them on consignment at stores, who then would call her amazingly and say, oh my God, we sold all that mohair, we need more. So it all started with that. So she'd go, I'd ship more down, she'd take the bags full over, she'd collect a check for what got sold, and we were kind of off and running. Florida had a lot of stores then, 300 or 400 stores in Florida. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't have anywhere near that number now. The stores that remain are good. It's a very good territory for me still, but those days it was wild.
And so eventually you had more than one rep, right? More than your mom, right?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Carrie Adams, who is still repping in the Northwest and on the West Coast, bugged me for years. Well, I don't know how many years it really was, but it was a substantial amount of time. I want to rep your line, I want to rep your line, I want to rep your line. And finally, I consented. And I have to say that she did amazing things for me on the West Coast. That really, getting that kind of exposure on the West Coast was, it really helped put Prism on the map. That's a very big deal.
It's definitely on the map. Now, let's move backwards from Prism for a second, because I want to talk about your art. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge fan of your art. It involves weaving. I love weaving, as you know. There was a time, of course, that the market wasn't there, but I know you're still doing your art. It's gorgeous. And I'd love it if you could tell our listeners a little bit about your art and also a little bit about your loom, because your loom is a great story, too.
The loom is a great story. Well, we'll start there. We'll start with the loom. Actually, you know what? I'm going to back up a little bit, and I'm going to start with the last year that I was in college.
Okay.
So we had very, very good equipment. Because the school was new, so I was spoiled. I had been working on very good equipment. We had I promise not to bore all the non-weavers with a lot of technical stuff, but in case there's somebody out there who is into weaving, I'll mention a little bit. So we had Maycomber looms, and we had a lot of 8 harness, but we also had some 16 harness looms. And the way that my interest developed was really structural. This is a two-part story. The first part is that in this day, and for everybody who knows my work, both my artwork and my yarn, I am known for color. I mean, I am known as having a good eye with color. And a lot of people assume that you're born with that kind of thing, and I'm here to attest that you are not born with that kind of thing. I didn't have a clue what to do with color. And the whole time that I was in weaving, everything that I did was white. I did all these white weavings that simply concentrated on woven structure. So I did a lot of double weaves. I did a lot of pattern weaves. I learned how to weave. I learned all about weave structure, and then I was doing double weaves that were sculptural. So they actually would have, it's kind of like short rowing in knitting. So you would build up triangles of areas and then bring another layer up and pull that back so it would become this big shadowed pleat on the surface of the knitting or the weaving. See, I can't tell the difference anymore between the two. At any rate, everything that I did was white. And the reason for that was I didn't know what to do with color. I was scared of color, and I decided that I was not going to use color if it was only arbitrary. If all I could do was say, oh, I'm going to make a blue weaving, well, then I wasn't going to do it. And finally, this part's funny. It was not required at that time. The programs are a lot more rigorous now in terms of what is required classes. But at the time, it was not required to take a color class. So I didn't take a color class until my very last semester. And it absolutely changed my life. I struggled and struggled and struggled with learning what he was trying to teach us. Kind of difficult concepts because they weren't formula-based, and this is how I teach color as well. Not formula-based. In other words, you learn a whole lot about color by understanding how we see color and then understanding how colors interact with one another. And that means that aside from kind of knowing what the color wheel is, it's not formula-based. You don't walk out of one of my color classes or this color class saying, okay, well, if you put these colors and these colors together, it's always going to be successful. No, you learn how to see color. And that's an interesting process. At any rate, after struggling for several weeks with it, when I finally had my aha moments, I panicked. I realized that now that I actually knew what to do with color, I was about to graduate. I didn't have a loom. I didn't have any way to continue my studies, so I stayed another semester. Okay, I'll just stay another semester. I stayed another semester and, in fact, made by far the best work of my college career and the work that got me into galleries when I did finally graduate. So upon graduation, I took a job with the University of Michigan, and this is a little sidebar, but this is funny, and people seem to enjoy this story. We had a concert office, as most universities do, and ours was very well honored within the we won Billboard Magazine's College Promoter of the Year, year after year after year, when I was in college. And we ran those concerts with volunteer ushers. And I was the head of all of it, not the concert office, but the volunteer ushers. So everything that happened in front of the stage, from the stage to the doors, I was in charge of. And I took a job with the university after I graduated with the concert office, rolling that job into also being their bookkeeper, which I had learned bookkeeping because one of my work-study jobs was the assistant to the dean's assistant. So I had this really eclectic education that was probably not what most people would think of as an art school education. At any rate, so I immediately purchased a small loom, a little baby Mac, 24 inches wide, and spent all my spare time weaving on that little loom and continuing my explorations. And then, and it's funny. I mean, most kids, when they graduate from college, they want a car. Not me. I got a loom. And shortly after that, I was moving to Buffalo to be with Matt, and I had saved up enough money to buy, a car. And instead, I bought a bigger loom because they cost the same. My first loom cost the same as a car. And it was huge. It was a monstrous loom, 20 harnesses, 54-inch weaving width, And when I talked with my professor about buying this loom, she looked at me and said, now, Laura, you understand that this is a big commitment, because once you have this loom, it's now going to limit where you can live. Because it's so big, you can't get it in and out of doors.
No.
So that was true until we wanted to move to a place where that loom needed to go into the attic, which was going to be my studio. So my dear husband, who is a machinist by trade, owned a machine shop, it can fix anything, can build anything, looked at it and said, oh, no problem, and he took it apart. He took it apart. He moved it into the attic. He put it back together. We made improvements. So.
Well, okay, so you've got the loom, and you finally decided to augment your loom.
I'm sorry, say again?
You augmented your loom. Little tech involved.
I did. I had a tremendous amount of luck with grants for artists. I don't know. I think it was beginner's luck. But almost every grant that I ever applied for, I got the first time I applied for it. I didn't necessarily get them the second and third time, which is interesting, but the first time. So back when they used to have individual artist grants through the NEA, some of them were pretty substantial. They had two levels. They had a $5,000 grant and they had a $25,000 grant. And I applied for one when I was very young. And I got one, but I got a $5,000 grant, and that was 1992. And I used that grant money to purchase a system that was developed actually for handicapped weavers. And it was one of the very first computer-assisted looms, but it was a retrofit package for my existing loom. And it consisted of 20 air cylinders that were placed over each treadle and then connected each to one harness. Now, I guess I should describe my work a little bit again for some of the people who know weavings. So I'm working on 20 harnesses and doing complex double weaves that had up to 5 layers of threads in the warp, some of which wove independently and some of which were supplementary warps, meaning that they could come up but they wouldn't actually make another layer of fabric. They would just come up and weave along with other things, other threads. And I was able to imitate or evoke lots of layer transparency, lots of the look of transparency with this system. And when I wove by hand, totally by hand, before I had the computer set up, I would have to crawl underneath the loom every inch or two of weaving and change the tie-up. I also pretty much destroyed my back because Maycombers have wire heddles, and each harness weighs about 10 pounds. So I'm weaving on 20 harnesses, sometimes having 17 harnesses hooked to the same treadle. And although there's two mechanical advantages in there, it's not that I'm lifting 170 pounds, nonetheless, I'm tromping on a pedal that is lifting a tremendously large amount. And the only way when I had that many harnesses hooked up that I could make it work was to actually jump on it. So I was jumping on it with all of my weight. For those of you who've never seen me live, I'm not that big a person. I'm 5'3" and fairly athletic, but nonetheless, it's a lot of activity. And the worst part about it is that you're leaning over, because it's a 54-inch wide weaving width, but you might have to step on a pedal that's all the way at one end and then shoot the shuttle from the other end. So at any rate, needless to say, it was bad for me. But the computer system allowed me to weave, still hand weave. I'm still shooting the shuttle through by hand, but it allowed me to just use the air cylinders to lift the treadles. And I promised you that I was going to tell you an interesting story about spoken word, because we were talking earlier about blogs and listening to radio to podcasts, as opposed to reading or listening to music. And early on, I made an odd discovery. Now, okay, so I'm weaving with up to five layers of threads. So sometimes, so that means in every dent on the reed, there might be five layers, five threads going upward, and they're all separated and going through these 20 harnesses. It's very, very complicated to get everything in the right place. So I'm make lots of errors. It's almost impossible. I mean, I'm weaving at 18 threads per inch, 12 to 18 threads per inch. Yeah, it's pretty fine work. And it's a lot. It's just a lot of threads. And I found, interestingly enough, that if I listen to music, my mind wanders and I make mistakes. If I have silence, and I'm actually a big proponent of silence, I like silence, but if I have silence, my mind wanders and I make mistakes. If I listen to spoken word, if I listen to people talking, I might miss whole swaths of what they said, but for some reason, my mind is more focused on what I'm doing and I made far fewer mistakes. So I became a early champion of talk radio, although I have, you know, I don't like nasty talk radio, but talk radio, there's a lot of good programs out there, and audiobooks. So that's, I used to read a lot. I listen a lot more than I read. And we do that here at PRISM. After employees are well trained, they're allowed to listen. They can have headphones and audiobooks because it actually focuses you. It's a very interesting thing. At any rate, did I get way off track?
No, you didn't. Not at all. I actually agree with you, and I found that for my own part, I tend to like talk radio, and when I'm in the car, I tend to listen to NPR. I actually download a ton of other people's podcasts and listen to them. I just find it my mind doesn't wander when I listen to them. I may miss what they're doing, but I can still keep myself on task for the other things I'm doing. Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the point I wanted to make about your upgrade, your technology upgrade, because, you know, with that much weight, and you really did need some kind of an automated system.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that the computer that is running it is still there, and it's old, right? it's really old. It's like a Commodore 64 or something like that, right?
Yes. Okay, let's see. Sidebar. Does everyone know that the first computers were looms? The first punch card computers were looms in China in the 15th century.
Jacquard
True
loom.
Story.
Yep.
Jacquard looms. So computers and looms go way, way back. And this was a prototype loom. I mean, this was the first year that they had this system that I bought it. And it really jumped me right into the computer age in a good way, because now instead of doing drawdowns and crawling underneath, I do inputs. I mean, I became a computer programmer. Granted, it's a very specific programming that I'm doing, but nonetheless, it's programming. Because it was very new to them as well, they had their own proprietary software driving this system. And it kept crashing on me, and of course, inevitably, it would crash when I'm on a deadline for a commission or a show or something. And the only recourse was to send the loom driver, which I only recently learned that's what they called them. Back then, we just called it the box. I would have to send the box back to the loom company, who would send it to the programmer who would make it work. Well, he made it work. I don't know what he did. But I now have a single solitary loom driver that works on my loom and my computer only. And it works with, it's so old, 1992, that it was built for Commodore whatever, 64
yep.
technology. I actually have a 286. Does that sound right?
That's right.
Yep. That's what's running it. And when we've tried to upgrade the computer to something better, it won't run the software. So I have this old 286 that Matt keeps burping and farting and making it work. One of these days, it's not going to want to work anymore, and I'm going to have to just get a new Voom driver, I guess, is what.
I would get out on eBay, and I'd find another one just like that and just mothball until it. I would. Scare the hell out of me. Okay. Well, I just wanted them to hear about your technology because, you know, you're dealing with high technology there, and I thought that was really important. just as a sidebar, you know, those people out there who know about weaving know that there's a process we call a drawdown, which is the way that we figure out how warp and weft is going to interact with each other. If that isn't programming, I don't know what is programming. That is programming.
Yeah, it is. It is.
It's absolutely. So I think that weavers who get that tend to inherently be good programmers anyway.
That's interesting. Yeah, I don't see why not, actually.
No, it is absolutely programming. All right, well, let's move on from your loom. And we've talked a little bit about Prism. And let's talk about you as an artist for a little bit as a color dyer. You make some really gorgeous yarns. I've seen them. We've all seen them. I think one of the things that people would want to know is, you know, where do these come from? Where do you get inspired by these things? I mean, there's that great conversation that you and I had at opening day where, you know, I looked at it and said, I don't get that color. I can't see it. You know, it's gorgeous. You know, can you talk to us about how you see it?
Yeah. I was listening to something, or no, I read something the other day that really resonated with me, and it was about taking a walk in the woods and being a scientist. And what they meant was that when you walk, don't get all wrapped up in your thoughts. Look at the world around you. Really look at the world around you. Look at everything about the world around you. And that's what I do. I see color in everything. I remember when I lived in Buffalo still, and my mom lived in Florida, and I was visiting her, and I went to see a gallery a writer in Sarasota who was very tied into the art scene. And she was kind enough to see me and look at my portfolio, and she had kind of an alternative space. And it wasn't the right work for her space, but she spent quite a bit of time talking to me. And her comment was, this is a really tropical palette for someone who lives in Buffalo. And I realized that is what my color teacher had done for me, was to open my eyes just to really look at the world in all of its minutiae. It's almost a micro view of everything. And when you do that, you start to see, you just start to see more. So I think that's where it comes from. I'm unquestionably inspired by the natural world. And I do that tremendous amount of looking at every level. And people say that to me often. Well, I don't see that. I don't see those colors. But when I pointed it out to you, then you did, right?
I did. I mean, you know which one I'm talking about. It was like shale and sand, right?
Uh-huh.
And you showed me it, and then you showed me the color you got. And the color was gorgeous. And it was something that I found very appealing. But I really couldn't see the inspiration in it, and I know that you go through a methodology that's very different than a lot of other people. We walk around and we're so busy that people say like, dislike, and you have a philosophy about that.
Yeah, help me out. What are you trying to?
You always talk a little bit about, you know, suspending what you think, and really just looking for the color in it, you know, and how the things that you've seen before will influence you much later on. One of the things that I thought was really interesting is you build up this color palette in your head that stays with you.
It's Yeah, it's kind of a holistic approach to everything. You know, life, the universe, as they said in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, life, the universe,
life.
And everything. Yeah, it's like that. It's just the way I live, and I can't. It's so second nature to me. I guess that I'm always constantly processing, always processing. And I think, you know, it's interesting. I take very good photographs. I don't know very much about cameras. Poor Lexi tried to coach me a little bit on some things, but I'm afraid I'm hopeless about that. But I take very good pictures because of the way I look at things. All right, so they might not be technically excellent pictures in terms of, they're good pictures in their framing, and they're good pictures in the visuals of it. And I'll never be a professional because I don't have the patience to learn all that camera stuff. But I think that once you look the way an artist looks, that you just always see the world that way. In other words, I never stop that. It's not like I go home at night and stop being an artist. I don't. I go home at night, and on the drive home, I'm processing everything the same way. How's that look? How's that looking tonight? What's the water looking like as I drive across the bridge? What, you know, what are the shades of the flowers right now? What phase are they in? I don't know. Lots of processing.
That's exactly what I was trying to get to, that for you it really never stops. And,
that's right.
And I think that's, in a way, has got to be exhausting.
I don't know. That's an interesting point. It does make it, I mean, it's true, I never turn it off.
Right.
And I guess in some ways that is exhausting. I mean, I never even go on vacation because I'm still always processing. It's just kind of what I do.
It's totally fine. It's who you are. And
I
think it comes out in your work. So let's talk about your work, and let's talk about Prism and the industry in itself. Your colors are gorgeous. And, we've gone through a hard economic time in the last couple of years. I think that we're not done seeing the worst of our times. I think we're not quite out of the woods. I think that there's always optimism. And I know you're very optimistic, but it's been challenging. And, you know, so what do you think? I mean, what do you see coming in the future? Put your crystal ball in front of you and tell me what's going to happen. We're all going to be okay.
Yeah, I wish I was that prescient. I'm not. But I've been around a long time, and I've been through the good times, and I've been through some of the bad times, and I've seen other crashes and burns, and we've always managed to pull ourselves back out. We, the industry, has always managed to pull ourselves back out. There are some encouraging things, I think, overall. One of them is that, and when I was president of TNNA in 2000, and that was the buildup, if you all remember, to a whole big craze in knitting. And that's when Julia Roberts was on every talk show talking about knitting, and there was a huge craze. And a lot of it had to do, frankly, with Julia talking it up so that a whole lot of young people thought that maybe this was a cool thing, maybe they should look into it, and discovered the joys of it. A lot of the booms that we had seen prior to that were the typical crafting turnover, where people would knit for a while and then they'd lose interest in knitting, and they'd be all hot on needlepoint for a while, and then they'd go back to knitting for a while. And so it was kind of like the same audience, and we just kept trading them back and forth. But that knitting boom that was driven by Julia, or spurred on by Julia, that one brought a lot of new people to the table. And I talked about it a lot in those years because, as president of the association, I kept getting phone calls from media because we were such a hot story. Knitting was such a hot story. And I talked at the time. I mean, I had to think about it. I had to, okay, so what am I going to talk to these people about when they say, why is knitting so popular? What am I going to say? It's not just Julia. There are reasons why knitting is popular. And crochet and other handcrafts. And it's the same reason that, frankly, gourmet cooking is popular, and the same reason that gardening is popular. And that is that humans are tool makers. I mean, we have these beautiful opposable thumbs that allow us to do things that animals can't do. I mean, there's three things that set us apart from the animals: our big brains, our opposable thumbs, and our larynxes, which have language. And of course, those things all go hand in hand. At any rate, funny aside, I was in having a conversation in a restaurant the other night with someone who was a real Darwinian, no, survival of the fittest, and we shouldn't help people, and they should just sink or swim on their own, and we're no different from the animals. And I said, of course we're different from the animals. And he said, no, we're just the same. And I said, really? And he said, well, how are we different? I said, by the fact that we're sitting here having a conversation in which we disagree, and we're not tearing each other's throats out. And he kind of stopped and looked at me. I said, okay. You know. We are different. Come on. At any rate, all of those things, you know, we've been living in these really information-intensive years. And information is wonderful, but information also can be a little sterile. And for people who deal with information all day long, and that's all they deal with is information, knitting is a lovely respite for that. Knitting allows you to do something creative, and productive and soothing and all of the things that we know are good about knitting. And that's a really important thing. And so now I forgot why I ever got started talking about that particular thing.
No, we were talking about the reasons, yeah.
Yeah. I think that there are very many reasons that knitting is going to stay popular. I mean, I think all of those things really make knitting resonate with people. What we're seeing right now is a shift in the marketplace and how it functions. And there are definitely good things happening, and there are definitely challenging things happening. And what's challenging is that the old model of mill, distributor, wholesaler, retailer, the lines are getting blurred. And there are people who are not going to survive that. There are people who are in some way in one of the traditional roles who are not going to survive. There's so much competition, and people are finding new ways of procuring their materials. And sometimes those ways are better, and sometimes they're not as good. But, you know, if you live in a remote rural area, well, the internet is a godsend to you. Stitches is a godsend to you if you are lucky enough to be able to travel to it and see what's in the marketplace. If you are a brick-and-mortar store who is in a smaller area, and because there isn't enough business for you to provide the variety, you might be in trouble. You have to find creative ways of making yourself more valuable than whatever discount we can get online. And so people are having to redefine themselves. And I know Prism, we had to redefine ourselves not that long ago when this whole schlump happened. And I guess, you know, I don't know, 2006, I guess, is when it kind of hit hard. Our business went down quite a bit. And part of it was because people were not so interested in novelty yarns anymore. Well, I have always done more than just novelty yarns, but I had gotten into a place where people came to Prism more for novelty yarns than for regular hand-dyed yarns. And I spent a lot of time trying to redefine us as being also a very good hand-dyed yarn company. That, you know, let's not forget that color is where I started and where I came from. I added novelty yarns because I was interested in them as time went along, but it was not ever our first thing. It was only an adjunct thing. And it was a long, hard slog to sort of redefine that and to get people to realize that, oh, yeah, that's right. She does really pretty traditional yarn as well as novelty yarns. So everybody's got the challenges of figuring out how they're going to fit into a quickly changing world.
Well, and you're talking about how you fit or brand or rebrand or remarket a company that's already doing something or shifting the focus. And that's one part of it. I think it's hard because you are not somebody that has the luxury of just doing that every day. I mean, please tell our listeners how you spend your day.
My days are pretty crazy. I'm an early riser. I'm a natural lark. So that's fortunate for me because I like to get up, get at it, and I wake up generally full of energy. And I'm not very good at night. So I easily fit myself into a typical work schedule. And so up and breakfast, and I do treat myself to reading the paper because if I don't do it first thing in the morning, I'm probably not going to do it. And I really like being aware of what's going on in the world. So I get up and off I go, and Prism is, there's some surprising things about Prism. People are often surprised to learn that I still dye every piece of yarn that leaves Prism. I don't have dyers. I have support staff. There are seven people working full-time at Prism. And I have a studio assistant who does all the heavy lifting and yarn prep. But as far as mixing the dye and putting the yarn into the dye, that's me. That's me who does that. So a huge amount of my day is spent on dyeing. Well, for anybody who's dyed, you know that it's a bunch of prep, and then you go away for 45 minutes while the chemical reactions take place. So in that 45 minutes, I go back to my desk, and I do everything else that has to be done. I write patterns. I work on our model program. I do whatever the current ads that are due. I make the ads. We do all our own self-publishing in terms of patterns, so I do the photography for that. I do all the layouts. I went ahead and took a course in Photoshop and InDesign so that I could do all of that stuff. And in all of that, my art training has stood me very well because a really good, rigorous art program teaches you not only the skills of art making, but the critical thinking and critique oriented practice of being an artist, which means that, and people tend to think of artists as being, la-di-da, and what we're not. Really good artists are really focused and they're very good problem solvers. That's what visual art is. It's visual problem solving. At least to me it is. The brand of art that I practice is. So what else do I do? Lots of customer service. My days are just really filled with all of the stuff that comes from running a small business. What else?
Well, you do everything. I mean, the point I was trying to make is that it's a job by itself to take a company and retask it and remarket and re-educate your buyers, and at the same time, you're still dyeing every skein. I mean, that's Herculean.
Yeah. And I've had dyers in the past. I've never been totally satisfied. Dyeing is not a science. It is an art. Even though I have recipes and I follow my own recipes, it doesn't matter. I have to actually look at everything that comes out and often have to adjust things because they don't, there's too many variables. So then you add traveling into it. All right. And of course, you know how much I travel because I come to all four Stitches events and I do a few other things, two TNNA shows a year,
right,
and some store events. And here's what happens. I never really take a vacation. All I do is rearrange my schedule because for me to go away means that I have to have enough work in the queue to keep my entire staff busy while I'm gone. That's something people don't think about. Oh, well, yeah, oh, did you have fun at Stitches? Well, yeah, I had fun at Stitches, but, you know, now I have to come back. And for the days, because Stitches, of course, are always over weekends. So there I am. I spend the weekend at Stitches. And then usually the weekdays on either side traveling, because in Florida it's pretty hard to get anywhere. I mean,
right.
Yeah, I pretty much can't get home on Sunday night most of the time. So it's Monday traveling, and then I go directly to work, and I start dying again, because by that time they will have processed everything that I dyed for them to do before I left. So, yay! It's a lot.
We have a question in the chat room, real quickly. Spinning Buddy wants to know, how much yarn does Laura dye in one lot?
You know, we have the capability of dyeing 40 pounds of wool at a time. But because we dye to order, I don't often dye that much, because we have to have that much on order. There are certain things that we do that we keep in stock, so I try to do 40-pound batches. But a typical batch is probably more like 20 pounds, and I will dye as small as a 2-pound lot. So in a given day, I could easily dye 100 pounds of yarn with the different processes that are all going on at the same time. But not every day. That would be a good day.
That'd be a good day, absolutely.
100 pounds, 100 pounds would be figure 8 skeins per pound. So.
Okay. That's neat. That's neat. But I know what you're talking about, the traveling, and I do pretty much the same schedule that you do. I do 4 Stitches shows. It's funny, I have to go to those. And Tuesday and days. And then I try to get out to, you know, see some of the advertisers and do the occasional in-store event, and it seems like it's never kind of done. You're always traveling. It's good. We all like each other, and it's all fun, but it's not what they call downtime.
No, there isn't. Right. You know what? The best downtime for me is if I manage to get upgraded and I can sit in the first class cabin on the way home.
There you go. There you go.
Yay.
There you go. Well, but you do have a nice support system, and I want to talk about your support system, because I'm a big fan of his. You have Matt. Matt's pretty awesome.
I do, and he is awesome. He is. He's. I wouldn't be where I am today or what I am today without Matt. He has been my number one cheerleader, my number one support staff, my number one, sure, we can do that. Doesn't matter what it is I want to do. Sure, we can do that. Honey, I want this system of copper plates on which I'm going to float my weavings, and they need to have these perfectly machined slots put in them so I can put glue Velcro on the back, and then I'm going to put patina on them. Can we do that? Sure, honey, we can do that. And he figures out how to do it. And, and I want them to not be flat. They need to be a little shadow box. So we've got to find somebody who can roll the edges and make this little, sure, honey, and he finds the fabricator. Okay, now I want to do painted panels, and I want them to do this, this, and this. Sure, and he finds somebody who can do that. It's just really, it's really amazing. And as I said, he was a machinist, still is a machinist, not that he machines much anymore, but he became a machinist. I mean, by the time he was 14 years old, he was working full-time in the summers in his dad's machine shop. And by the time he was 16 years old, I love this story. By the time he was 16 years old, he was a journeyman machinist. And his dad, remember when, you might not remember, but some people will remember, when the auto plants would shut down for a week for model changeover in the summer. They don't really do that so much anymore, but they used to. And so that was a big deal every summer, when, like over the 4th of July weekend, when they would shut down for model changeover. It's also when they would repair the lines. And Matt's dad had a machine shop in Buffalo, New York, and they were a job shop, meaning that they did things to order, kind of like Prism does. They were a job shop with machining, tool and die work, manufacturing parts, as they were needed by whomever needed them. And they would be called in to repair the lines very often. And by the time Matt was 16, he and his 18-year-old friend were being sent by his dad into the auto plants to repair the lines, which is
wow.
Amazing. Yeah.
It is?
Yeah. It is. It's really amazing. So he just, I can't say enough wonderful things about
my
husband.
Well, he's just so kind and calm and funny. And
yeah, he is that. he definitely
so,
is that.
He's so funny. All right. Well, we'll get off the Matt fan club right now, and we'll move on to the next thing. So one of the things that you are among the Merry Many things is you're one of our very best Stitches instructors. And you don't do classes that are – you do classes that are very different than other people's classes. Would you like to tell us about your classes a little bit?
Sure. Sure. You know, and thank you for that, by the way. That's very kind to say that I'm one of your best. You have really awesome teachers at Stitches, and I'm proud to be counted as one of the best. Thank you. My approach to teaching is to say, what do I do that other people don't do? You know, what is it that I bring to the table that maybe not everyone else has? And I think that it is that art training. So, and I know I scare people. They think, oh, my God, I can't do that. You know, I have to be an artist to be able to learn from an artist. And that's not true. Although I teach art and design issues, I teach them in really friendly ways. In other words, I know how to get the concept across to you, being any person in my classes. Even if you don't think you know anything about color, that's why you would come take a color class from me, because I can get you to understand things about color that you never even knew existed. And, you know, people talk about color wheels and formulas and all that stuff, and they say, I try to use that and it still doesn't look good. Well, that's right, because just learning what that is doesn't teach you how to put colors together. So my approaches are very unorthodox. Now, I'm mostly a self-taught knitter, and my own knitting is really unorthodox. So I actually, while I'm technically a good knitter, I pretty much can knit anything. I can figure out how to teach and how to knit anything. That's not what I excel at in teaching. We have really superb technical knitters who teach fabulous classes. What you come to me for is color, design, how you put the whole package together in one big thing. It's not how to learn to do 7 different cast-ons. Even if I can do them, I'm not the right person to be teaching that. It just doesn't make any sense. So, and of course, there's hand-dyed yarn. Since I've been working with hand-dyed yarn for the past, well, really 35 years, because I started dyeing yarn when I was, all my weavings, I dye yarn. That's where it all grew from. And what I do in my weavings informs what I do in knitting, and vice versa. They're always giving me ideas for color combinations and ideas for, you know, again, because I never stop. It's like, oh, yeah, look what happened there. Oh, I can use that in my next colorway in Prism, because that was a really cool thing. So I do that, and I probably always did it reasonably well, but I think that I do it very well now because I've concentrated on how to get those concepts across to people. And really, I try hard to make it fun, because people who come to Stitches, they are spending their hard-earned money. They're adults. They deserve to have fun. They deserve to learn things. And they deserve to have all of that be done in the most pleasant and enjoyable way possible. So I try to keep it fun and entertaining. And you know, who knew I was a stand-up comedian? But sometimes.
No, you are funny. I've seen you before. You are funny. I think it's really important because we tend to emphasize knitting, but your classes.
Right.
Most of your classes are good for crocheters, too.
Yes, they are. They really are. And there's been an interesting thread on Ravelry about about crochet and classes and the crochet classes at Stitches. And, of course, it was a year ago or – no, I guess it was
a year ago. Yeah.
When you started talking about what can we do at Stitches vis-a-vis crochet to make it more friendly. And I immediately said to you, listen, I crochet the same way I knit. I'm very intuitive. I can crochet pretty much anything, but I'm not a good technical teacher. However, I understand both with knit stitches and with crochet stitches how color works. Okay? I understand that. So I can teach, I can make my classes crochet friendly really easily. And I spent a good 2 months working on the stuff to make my classes good for crocheters. And then I realized that although we stuck a little logo up that said that they were crochet friendly, I never really changed the description to tell people how, in fact, they are crochet friendly. So I have to do that before we do the next descriptions, because they're not just, it's not gratuitous. I enjoy crochet as much as I enjoy knitting, and I get it. I get what it does with color. I get how to make hand-dyed yarn look good in crochet. I get how to make colors look good, and I can teach you guys that stuff. It's interesting. Sidebar and funny story. I keep seeing entrepreneurs show up here in the little chat room, and that's kind of funny because, yeah, and the entrepreneur gene apparently ran really deep in me, because when I was 14 years old, I was crocheting mini skirts and purses, making clay beads and hanging them on the purses as fringe and selling them to our local boutique. So I was an entrepreneur back then. I guess that anybody who knew me as a kid was not surprised when I wound up being in business for myself.
I think you've got a sense about who you are. I mean, and when you speak in your classrooms or publicly or just talk to people, you're very sure of yourself, and not in an ugly way, in a very positive way. I think it comes across to other people. I think it's infectious, actually.
Oh, good. That would be a good thing to be infectious. Yeah, I like that.
I think if you can be creative and have that creativity and that kind of yes, you can do this thing, be infectious. I don't know how that's not a good thing.
Well, I think that so much of teaching is empowering people to draw on what they have already in them, and I think that what struck me as being so interesting about that discussion, were you following that line in the Ravelry group about so many people saying, well, no, I can teach myself any stitch. I don't need to go to a class. And I made a point in there at one point, which is, yeah, but good classes are so much more than just learning a stitch, so much more. And I think that on the national level, and I don't know that it's true at local yarn stores, I think in local yarn stores it tends to be a much more this is how you do this or a project-oriented class. But when you go to a national convention, what those teachers are doing is not just this is how you do this stitch. This is how you do the stitch, and here are all the amazing things that you can do with it. And that's the part that you can't get any other way.
You know, I absolutely agree. And since we're on this, we're going to transition into another project that you just finished up with, because I know that this is about empowerment, it's about communication, it's about education. This is knitting, but let's talk about your new book.
Okay. My favorite current subject.
Well, and I want to make sure that Barbara Hooligan listeners are very aware in the interest of full disclosure. This is a book called Artful Colors, Mindful Knits with XRX Books, which is one of the companies of XRX. And so I am absolutely biased here, have no trouble with that. And since you're all listening, you just kind of need to live with that. So off we go in talking about Artful Colors, Mindful Knits. I wanted to say that it's a beautiful book. You know, I'm not always in the the process early on when people are putting it together. I'm usually there at the, you know, hey, let's discuss the concept thing. And then I usually come in sort of later in the game and start working on the marketing and the sales and the events that we do behind it. But it's a wonderful process here in the office that as books and magazines get done, the pages get printed out in spreads and get put up on the boards. And it was just so colorful and beautiful. I mean,
it's colorful.
It is. So how long have you been working on this book?
Well, the book, this is actually, you know, everybody will laugh, but this is actually true. The book is 35 years of accumulated knowledge. Okay. But obviously I haven't been making that book for 35 years. But I put my heart and soul into it. I really did put everything that I've learned in 35 years of working with hand-dyed yarns into that book. The actual book took, I think it was 3 years ago at South that I started teaching a class that I call intentional patterning, which is about finding the magic number in a hand-dyed yarn and then employing that number to repeatedly and with control cause patterns to happen, typically either zigzag lightning bolt flashes or argyles or stacks, columns of color. And I said to Elaine, I think we need to talk about this. I think there's a book here. And she said, okay. I love that about Elaine. Okay.
For our listeners, really quickly, I want to just explain. Elaine Rowley, the R in XRX, handles our books. My partner handles our books and develops books. I just wanted to make sure that people understood who that
yes.
was. So,
and
please,
she was my editor on the book, which was a phenomenal process. At any rate, which I'll talk more about in a bit. At any rate, I said, yes, I think this is pretty cool. I think you need to see this. And she said, okay. So she came to class, and she said, yeah, it's pretty interesting. So let's see what this might look like. And I started fleshing out a book proposal. And she was concerned, and rightfully so, that the audience for that particular thing might be a little too small. So the more I thought about it, the more I thought, why am I limiting this book to just this? I know all of this other stuff about hand-dyed yarns. Why doesn't this book become about hand-dyed yarns, how they behave, what you can do with them? And so that's where we went. So the book has two focuses, two foci. One is on magic numbers and forcing patterning to happen, controlling it or harnessing it. And one is a tactic of randomizing. And randomizing is when you don't want any kind of patterning to happen. You just want to celebrate the color story. And so within that, so that was good. That's a good focus. I can go along with this, and the book is starting to take shape, and I've got all these projects that are one or the other. And I approached it in the way that I call the scientific inquiry method of knitting. And that is, I would say, okay, if I take a random number of stitches, what is this particular skein of yarn going to look like? And I would do that, and I would knit it on a random number of stitches. I think I picked 50. And sometimes good things happened, and sometimes bad things happened. So, okay, now, if I find the magic number, which the book explains in great detail how to find that magic number, if I find the magic number, and so I can control, I can control how the patterning happens, then what happens? Okay, now, if I change the stitch count by this much, then what happens? Okay, if I do this, then what happens? And it just led me down this whole road that I documented for all these different yarns. And I had multiple skeins of yarn from multiple different companies, although it was easy for me to walk back into the studio and take whatever I wanted to of Prism, I wanted people to understand that I wasn't just talking about Prism. The theory, the ideas, the concept behind what you can do with hand-dyed yarn, it applies to everybody's hand-dyed yarn. So used lots of other people's yarns, went through all of this, this happens, then this happens, and then I realized that if I was going to do all that, I really had to talk about color. So I started to think about how I was going to talk about color, and it's interesting. For as long as I've been teaching color, people have been taking my color classes have been saying, you need to write a book. And I could never see a way to write a book about color. And part of the problem is that, well, there's just lots of problems. But I did see a way to incorporate a whole chapter on color and how we see color, which is really important to know how we view color, how our eyes see color, how colors interact with one another, and how that all relates to hand-dyed yarn. So this book then grew to include that. Now, here's a funny story on Benjamin. Because, you know which one I'm going to say. Because,
I think I do.
Because around December, and he's right, he hadn't really, we had had very little conversation, Benjamin and I. I think the last time we had talked was probably at Stitches East. And then everything was going along fine, and he was out of the loop. And he said to his staff, I guess I better look at the intro to this book so I can start thinking about how we're going to market it. And now, in the course of all of this, we had the patterns and the projects, and we had all these case studies. And case studies were what I called the thread that I followed from one to another to another to another swatch with the same yarn. Okay, so those are case studies. So we had all this material, and where Elaine was instrumental in turning it into a good book was in helping me to sort out how that all got organized in a user-friendly way. At any rate, so Benjamin said, so print out the intro. Well, they were calling all of those information chapters intro. And somebody looked at Benjamin with, I think, a raised eyebrow and said, now, Benjamin, you do know that the intro for this book is 42 pages long. And Benjamin said, what? What? And he went over to editorial and he said, what on earth are you doing giving me a book with 42 pages of introduction? And Elaine said, well, no, Benjamin. And anybody who knows Elaine can see her saying it pretty much like that. Well, no, Benjamin. You know, well, no, Benjamin, really. And so now what I have taken to saying is that it isn't 42 pages of intro. There's a one-page intro. And then there's 41 pages of content.
Right.
And that
right.
content is really tutorial. And it, for the people who take the time to read it, and I tried very hard to make it entertaining enough that you would be engaging enough, for the people who take the time to read it, it will change your life. It will change how you look at color. It will change how you look at hand-dyed yarns. If you're a dyer, it will change how you dye. If you're a spinner, it will change how you spin. It's not the be-all and end-all. It's not the final lesson, but it is a pretty good start in how it all works visually.
Well, it's you know, it's phenomenal. You know, you've talked about it many times, and I don't want to get into things that you've talked about before, but it's never been, this has actually never been covered before. And
no, it's new stuff.
It's new stuff, and I think it could be considered almost scary stuff because there's a lot of power in what you're doing there. And yet, you know, I don't know if you know this. I checked last week. This book was on last month's or the current Unicorn top 10 books. In fact, it's in number one position right now. So congratulations on that.
Yay.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's a pretty heady – this is not a soft book. This is a pretty heady book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean – there's a lot of packed in there. So the process of writing it, I know that you know, we've talked about that before a little bit with Myra when she was on the show. The process of working on a book with XRX is interesting, wouldn't you say?
It is. It actually suits me incredibly well. It was a very good process for me.
It's intense.
Well, I had written this was my sixth book, so. I had written 5 other books, and they were with a very nice publisher to whom you gave a finished manuscript. And you gave them a manuscript, and then they designed the book. And they technically, you know, they did technical editing, and there was a certain amount of give and take in terms of that technical editor coming back to you with questions, and you had input, and they did then the photography and the layouts, and gave you galleys, and you made corrections or whatever, and then it went and got published. With this one, and I knew I couldn't do this book with that publisher. I knew that I didn't know where I was going with it. I also knew, and that particular publisher has a very talented photographer who does beautiful work, but he's not Alexis. And Alexis's work, who is the photographer for XRX, he's another one of the X's in XRX, and his photography is just spectacular. So, I mean, I came to XRX with this book because of Elaine and because of Alexis. I wanted his photography and I wanted her brains. And I was right. I needed that. I needed the kind of input that she was able to give me to make that book become what it had the potential to be. And I don't know who else could have done it, but at any rate, that interesting process of, I mean, I'm very self-motivated, and there wasn't, it was more an empowering thing for most of it. I listened to Myra talk about her process, and mine wasn't exactly the same. I think mine was already evolving for me, going places that I wanted it to go, and basically Elaine just kept giving me permission. She just kept saying, "Uh-huh, go ahead." Okay, Elaine, I want to include all this part about color. Okay, go ahead. Yes, I think you're right. That would be very good. And you can hear her saying that too, can't you?
I can. And I don't want to give people the idea that Elaine is somebody that just is going to say yes. Elaine actually has to agree.
Absolutely.
Elaine has to actually think it's a good idea to say yes. But if she thinks it's a good idea, even if it's a scary place to go, she's brave.
Yes. That's very true. That's very true. And I think we went into some pretty scary places with this book. Places that we weren't sure how exactly we were going to get the point across. And, I said Elaine and Alexis, but let me also say that your designer, Natalie, is unbelievable, and your illustrator, I think that's Carol, is also unbelievable. These are you have a very talented team. And
thank you. I think so too.
There's a lot of there's just a lot of good happening. There's a lot of good happening with that team.
Yeah, well, it's a lot of work, and you're right. There's a lot of people that put their time and effort into this, and if anybody out there ever picks up a book, do yourself a favor and look at the credits page, because you hear about the publisher and you hear about the author. But if you've enjoyed the book, trust me, it was not just the publisher and the author. There were a lot of people in that, and they're really unbelievably important parts of that whole process. The book finally came out, and we had our big debut at TNNA, and then we had our kind of consumer big debut at Stitches West, and It was great. I mean, we did our little author party on Thursday night, and you were gracious and eloquent when you spoke, and everybody seemed to really love the book. That moment must have been nice.
It was nice, and I've been getting a lot of comments, and they've all been positive, and comments from some people who really do know, comments from other industry people. An associate who owns another yarn company actually took the time to say, thank you for writing this particular book. This industry has needed this for a long time. I'm really glad someone finally did it. So that was kind of cool. Statnerd, who is one of the moderators of the Pooled Knits Ravelry group, and who was gracious enough to actually do some knitting for me for the book. She's got mad skills. She's really incredible. And who talked to me via email a lot about plan pooling and various things. And she was great. And she finally got, I finally got her copy to her, and she said, oh, yeah, you did good. So I was a nice atta girl.
Yeah.
And I think people have liked the patterns. I think we got that across pretty well. The idea that when you're doing this kind of work, the garments don't have to be the garments need to be simple. They need to be simple because what you're showcasing needs to speak. And so they get that. Then that makes it very easy to. Yarn substitute, because they're not so dependent on a particular yarn and exactly how it behaves or how it looks. I think that we managed to accomplish a few good things. And I'm just waiting for Amazon is still not shipping it, so I am hoping that's going to happen soon.
I have no idea why, because that's ridiculous.
I know. It's crazy, but I keep reading about people saying, oh, no, Amazon isn't shipping yet. And I'm like, okay. Well.
I still don't understand that. But, folks, the local yarn store.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lots of other places out there, if they're not doing it. There is no good reason other than there's some bureaucracy happening at the distributor level. I have no idea about that.
Right. I have no idea either. But... But at any rate, I'm kind of looking forward to seeing a review. I want to read a review.
I'm
hoping it'll be good.
I'll go up the right one. Yeah, I'll go up the right one, just so you can have it. Yeah, it was great. And so, on that line, that was a big thing you worked on. So what's the next big thing you're working on? Or are you just trying to get through this process?
We have a new... kind of dyeing style that we've been doing for about 2 years that we call layers. I talk about it in the book a little bit. Lots of dyers do sand wash solids, and those are really good color combinations to, but that's really nice to use with hand-dyed yarns, because if you put a multicolored hand-dyed yarn with a factory-dyed solid, the factory dyeing is too perfect. And it doesn't have the same feel. So a lot of us do sand wash solids, and they look kind of like suading, like washed denim. And what we kind of found out a few years ago is that if you do it with more than one color, instead of getting suading that's just tonal for that color, you get suading that is marbled with two parents and all of the children that those two colors can make together. So they're incredibly complex colors, and I've been working with them more and more, and now I'm starting to think about really cool ways to use those kinds of colors that might be outside the normal box of the way people think about combining colors. And I don't exactly know what that is yet. I just know that the way that my mind always works, this is how I describe it. When an image comes to me of what I want a weaving to look like, here's where, you see light best out of the corners of your eyes, because the rods are located around the perimeter of the retina. So you mostly notice that if you're out in a starlit night and you can see a bright star out of the corner of your eye, but when you turn your eye to that star, you can't see it very well anymore. It actually looks brighter out of the corner of your eye. So I kind of walk around the world looking at it out of the corner of my eye, because really intriguing things happen on the periphery. And so that's what I'm trying to do, and I can't always say what that is until it starts to come to fruition. So I'm not exactly sure what or where I'm going with these layers, colors, but I'm thinking it's going to be something cool.
I'm sure it will. I can't wait to see it. So before we start sliding out of here, did you want to tell our listeners where you're going to be, where you're going to be teaching soon, if you have any in appearances out there in the world?
Yes, in fact, I'm supposed to be sending you guys a list of this so that you can put it up on the website. Next, I will be at a store called Desert Designs in Dallas, Texas, and that is the second weekend in June. I'm going to be there Thursday and Friday. I'll be teaching a class, a magic number class, I think on Thursday. And maybe not. Maybe it's on Friday. I don't know. At any rate, there's a bit of a trunk show and a class. And then, of course, I'll be at TNNA for any store owners in mid-June. And then Stitches Midwest comes up, and I will be there. And I'm teaching an Etc. class at Stitches Midwest, which is the same Etc. class I taught at West last year, which turned out to be just a ton of fun. And we're calling it a color fantasia. And it's really, it's directed exercises to tune you up for seeing color. And there's lots of hands-on knitting in it. And there's lots of crazy stuff. There's a little magic number, and there's some colored paper things, and there's lots about how we see, and it's really a holistic approach to color. And of course, I'll be at East, although I will be there for a very limited time because I'll share why. Because my husband, my dear husband Matt, is currently vice commodore of our yacht club and will be commodore of our yacht club that when that event is on, and it is our Commodore's ball. And while the party is in honor of the outgoing Commodore, as current Commodore, he's really the host of the party. So I really have to be there to be with him. For as much as he's supported me through the years, I am not going to not be there for the Commodore's ball.
Absolutely. No, I completely understand that.
Yeah.
I wanted to go back. For those of you who don't know what an eccentric class is, it stitches at Midwest, it'll be Sunday and Monday. It's a two-day intensive where we kind of remove all the distractions. You stay with one teacher for 2 days. And, of course, on Monday there wouldn't be a market. And there's, I think, the max in a class is 20. So there's a lot of one-on-one time in those classes.
Yeah, actually, I had 20 people in the class at West, and we had a great time. It was really good. We learn a lot from each other. It's the art school joint. Everybody jumps in and does stuff, and then we talk about it and look at it and learn from what everybody did, sort of methodology.
Maybe I'll stick around and take it. I could probably use it. all right, Laura. Well, before we wrap this up, I asked everybody on the show to please, is there anything you want to say to the listeners, to anybody that you're thinking about right now, you know, upcoming designers, entrepreneurs, just people in our fiber world, anything you want to say to anybody?
You know, I knew you were going to do that. And I don't know that I have any particular words of wisdom, except that having been someone who unquestionably followed her passion, I would say, if that's what your passion is, go for it. Find a way to make it work. There is, you know, I didn't get rich off of this. I'm like everybody else. I'm scrambling to make a living. But it has been a wonderfully rewarding life. And I don't regret what I've done. I've made tremendous friends. It is very much like a family. You know, as I said in the very beginning, I don't think any of us wake up one day and say, gee, I think I'll have a life in the knitting industry. I mean, it just, you know, we tend to fall into it. it's a big tent, and there's room for lots of us, and there's room for lots of talent, and it's exciting to see people growing in ways that I didn't think of. You know, I like that. I like watching what people do that's not something I thought of. I mean, at one point, I was the person doing things that somebody hadn't thought of, and so now it's cool to see other people doing things that I hadn't thought of. Keeps me humble.
That's good. I like that a lot. Well, that's a great way to end out. That actually might end up being the quote for the show. All right. Well, I wanted to thank you for coming on the show, Lauren, for talking with us and taking your time. I know it's a busy day for you, and I hope I can persuade you to come back on the show in the future.
Oh, I'd love to, Benjamin. Always
Thanks
a pleasure
a lot
to talk with you.
It's always a pleasure, Laura. All right, folks. Well, folks, that was my guest, Laura Bryant from Prism Yarns. Make sure you keep up with Prism and Laura by visiting their website, prismyarn.com. You're going to want to bookmark that one. Next week, I'll have Kathy and Steve Elkins, who are co-owners of Webb's America's Yarn Store, on the show. They are two of my very favorite people. They're just fun. They are always bringing excitement and energy to the fiber arts world. They have their own podcast, Ready, Set, Knit, which is one of my favorites that I always tune into. And I've been privileged to have been a guest on their show many times, where they just sort of let me ramble on about me and what I'm doing. And so I'm so thrilled to be able to have them on Fiber Hooligan so we can finally talk about them. I don't know if they've ever been interviewed on another podcast, so this should be fun. It'll be a real kind of juxtaposition for them. Anyway, it's going to be great, and I hope you'll join us for this very cool show. If you missed any links that we mentioned here today, please don't worry. Well, I'm going to change that a little bit. I used to tell people that I'm going to put them up on fiberhooligan.com as show notes. But one of the things that I have found is that the process of going through and consolidating show notes keeps me from doing a better job on researching the next show and making sure that what you hear is the important part. So I'm not going to do show notes anymore. Instead, what I'm going to do is our dear friend, Fiber Hooliganette, Tammy Burke, established a great Ravelry group, and we're going to put some blurbs and some links out there. I think that's a better use of our time, because that way we can post a few important links and maybe even talk about some of the stuff that happened. So you'll be able to find more information about the episode over on the Fiber Hooligans group. I also do want to make sure that you know that I'm eager to hear from you. You can email me questions, recommendations, critiques, and feedback at benjamin@fiberhooligan.com. I don't promise to respond to every email or message, but I do promise to do my best to read them all. If you ask a really great question or have an inspired idea, or just because I may be feeling feisty, I may even read your email or message on the podcast. So be careful what you write, folks. It will be attributed. Well, I think that comes to the end of our show. I want to thank you for the great comments that I've gotten the last week and the support that my friends have shown me this last week. That's our show, Fiber Hooligans. And as we slide out of here today, I'd like to wish you all a glorious week. Remember, the only thing better than being creative is being kind to each other. And the good news, you can do both. Thank you for spending this time with me. I'll see you next week on another edition of Fiber Hooligans.